Napoleon did what his archaeologists did was they would ship stuff to the Vatican, okay? And the Vatican would like evaluate it. And the person they had evaluating this technology was Alessandro Volta, the guy who invented the battery. And did he really invent the battery, or did he
Oh
just
my
order
God,
one?
incredible.
Right. And so
What? He
he
didn't
had.
invent the battery, stole the battery from the Egyptians.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
William Sosa is back with us today on Dreamland. Bill was with us 2 weeks ago. We were talking about the Dendera light, and he has constructed a model of it. And today we're going to talk about the light a little more. We're going to be showing an image of the light in operation. And then we're going to, but before we do that, I'd like to, in some sense, respond to some of the questions that have been raised in my life, or and possibly also in the chat on YouTube, I'm not sure, about the source of the two things, the glass and the mercury vapor that would have been used in the past, because it's been pointed out that there's no evidence of glass making in Egypt. Is that true?
One of the things I did when I first started getting into, trying to reverse engineer or build the Dendera light is I only used things that I knew could be available then in the past. I kind of limited myself to, so I looked into glass making. If I'm no expert on it, but apparently glass making goes back, 4,000 years in Egypt, and they were making little bottles. There's images of them blowing glass in some of the drawings that I've seen, some of the texts I've seen in hieroglyphics, and as for the mercury itself, I lean on the information that's in alchemy. And I studied alchemy for a while there back in the 90s, and it didn't make any sense to me at all. There was all these bottles people were heating up, and they had snakes inside of them. And there's all this talk of using mercury and using sulfur, and how they're putting sulfur and mercury in these bottles. And it turns out, alchemy means the art of chem, the art of Egypt. All of this information, all this pre-chemistry knowledge was already known in Egypt in ancient times. So they had an ability, and the alchemists would put vacuum pressure in their glass bottles using an alembic. An alembic is kind of like a canning jar where you heat it up, and that heat expands the gas. You cork the bottle, or you seal the bottle, and as it cools, the gas would become under pressure, vacuum, just like a canning jar. And that's all you need to get a plasma bulb working. You don't need a full vacuum like you would in an incandescent lamp or in a Crookes tube. Those need a really high vacuum because you're going to be shooting electrons around. In a plasma tube, all you want is the gas under pressure so it can be easily ionized. And that was a pretty easy thing to do in the alchemical days of the early, 1100s. And if, considering that information came from Egypt, I can only assume they had the same knowledge.
So actually, they could have built these.
Absolutely. And
Absolutely.
One of the things that I find, I've seen the same, concerns. And a lot of this I dealt with years ago, back in the 90s and the early 2000s. And after I got the machine working in 2012, all of that information really wasn't important anymore, because now we had a technology. Now we had a physics that was modeling the stellar nebula. It's like, at one point, you got to ask yourself, I'll digress for a minute. People are always asking me, well, the next thing you need to build is using only Egyptian this and only Egyptian that. And I respond to that by saying, there's two directions I can focus my energy and my resources on. I can go looking into Egyptian stuff and try and explain more and more and more, improve more and more and more how they could have done this. But there's no artifacts to look at. So I'll never know if I'm actually right. It's kind of a dead end unless I'm going to go dig up all of Egypt and try and find the Dendera light. But in the other direction, the new physics, this idea that that this lotus cosmology, this living cosmology that the Egyptians talk about, that's testable. And as I move forward in my own research and dig deeper and deeper into the physics of the plasma tube, physics of this glowing plasma snake, I'm getting more and more and more closer to a understanding the universe. And with Jeff Webb, James Webb, the telescope out there right now, really dismantling the Big Bang on a daily basis, this cosmology is being proven more and more and more applicable. And that's, I think that's what we're going to find. I think the Egyptians knew. I think they knew we lived in an electric universe, and they could apply that knowledge, which is what they did at Dendera Temple.
Well, apparently so. I agree with you. And the reason I'm not too concerned about finding tools is that we don't find the tools. We don't find the tools that made the diorite bowls and the jars. We don't find the drills. And the drills had to be really, really hard and move really, really fast. They weren't hand carved. They were machined by something that we no longer possess. And it's really only the Eurocentric, modern-centric bias of the archaeologists and the Egyptologists that prevent us from just taking a look at how in the world this could be done. There are now quite a few very sophisticated efforts made to show the degree of finish on those bowls and jars, and there's no question that they were machined, not anymore. But where are the machines? And the answer is, they're wherever, whatever it was that was used to make the Dendera lights is, and we don't know where that is. There's also another thing, though. There's an unwillingness in the community, of the conventional community, to find things that contradict its expectations and beliefs. And so, for example, there's apparently space underneath the Sphinx that hasn't been addressed yet, and no plans to do so, for the simple reason that I guess they're convinced it doesn't contain anything worth spending the money to find, or they don't want to find it. I don't know which.
I have an opinion on the...
go ahead, yeah, please. Yeah.
Regarding the tools and regarding how they built, constructed with stone back then, the big mistake I think a lot of people are making today is they make the assumption that the stone was carved in the current state that it's in. And like you mentioned that we don't have the tools. Actually, we do. If we go to the Egyptian Museum, we're going to see all the tools they have. Copper tools, they had lathes, they had all kinds of very simple tools, but they also had a technology they're not showing us. This is what I've come to learn. And it's a technology that I call the soft and light technology. The Egyptians had a method, and actually it was also used by Edley Scanlon at Coral Castle, of making a stone soft as clay, light as cork. Edley Scanlon talked about this at length in his book on magnetic current, and the idea that his belief that matter was not the way we were portraying it today. It wasn't protons, neutrons, and electrons. He believed in a kind of a soap bubble with a magnetic material. He believed that there was this magnetic material. He writes about this in Magnetic Currents. There's a magnetic material that permeates all of space, all of the area around you. And that magnetic material clings to these soap bubbles, and the soap bubbles are what we would call protons. And the soap bubble accumulates this magnetic material, it becomes hard and heavy. This is how quasars turn into galaxies. When you see a quasar coming out, it's traveling at nearly the speed. I don't know if you're familiar with quasars. They're baby galaxies.
Oh, yeah, I know what they are.
Right. Halt and Arp proved that they come out in pairs out of the center of Milky Way, out of the center of galaxies. And as they come out, they're at the speed of light, or nearly the speed of light, traveling very fast. And their redshift, which is what they use to decide how far away and how fast things are traveling, their redshift is 200 times higher than the parent galaxy. So it has nothing to do with distance. It has nothing to do with speed. It has to do something with the state of the matter that is in that quasar. And what's happening, Coulthard mentioned this in his video, as the quasar is moving through space, it's acquiring, what he calls it, communicating with the universe. And it happens in stages. It's like it's going through waves of dust, waves of pollen or something that's accumulating on the material. And every time it happens, its redshift drops a little bit and it slows down. Its redshift drops a little bit, slows down. Eventually, this quasar gets so far out in space, and then it's now at the same redshift as its parent. It turns around and becomes a parent, a child galaxy of the parent galaxy. We, the Milky Way galaxy, we're a child of the Andromeda galaxy. And they've just recently discovered our sibling on the other side of the Andromeda galaxy. So Halton Arp was explaining how matter gets its mass. And what Ed Lee Scanlon was able to do at Carl Castle is he did the opposite. He was able to make a magnetic, I call it a magnetic froth, that can go into matter and wick out these magnetic material. Because according to Ed, if you can remove some of this magnetic material, you'll make the rock less heavy and less dense. And you can carve it like clay, and you can lift it very easily. It's not as heavy anymore. So this technology is widely used all over Mesopotamia. The Babylonians had it, Sumerians had it, the Egyptians had it.
It's also used in South America.
Yeah, Peruvians had it. The Easter Islanders had it. And as a matter of fact, I first came upon this, I think it was in a Graham Hancock book, but I've never been able to find the reference. But in the book, they were talking about how when the Spaniards came to South America, the Inca thought they were the gods. And so they brought them some of their prized possessions. And one thing was a golden flute. And the legend says that this golden flute could make stone soft as clay, light as cork. And it's only for a time. It's very similar to heating up wax with a heat gun. If you heat up wax with a heat gun, it gets soft for a while. But then eventually the heat, the room temperature returns and the wax gets hard again. Same thing happens with stone. When you can remove these magnetic materials, it becomes soft. You can carve it with a copper tool, or you can drill it with a simple pipe drill, or you can rotate it on a clay spinning wheel. Yeah, potter's wheel. And now all of a sudden, all of these wonderful things we're seeing in these diorite bowls becomes very easy. And it really explains things like how fast the drills were able to move through the rock, because we can see them, you know, going a very strong, big, large distance every time it spins around. It's like really digging fast. Well, the only way you can do that is if the stone is not in the brittle state and the hard state that it would be in after it returns back to its normal state. And I noticed when I was at Karnak, I was at the east end of Karnak, and they have this statue outside of a king and queen. And it's fairly big, and it's made of alabaster. And alabaster is a very, very brittle material. And yet you look at the construction on it, and it's got some detail that is just amazing. My wife's a sculptor. I've seen, you know, how she works. And sculptors, you know, they can really get fine detail, but they need the material to be soft to do it. Like, she does a lot of work in wax, and she has a heat gun. And if you look at the Babylonians and the Sumerians, I think they're seeing the technology in the pine cone device. Okay. If you look at these people, they have a handbag, they have a pine cone, they have wings, and they have a what looks like a wristwatch. And all of these parts come together, I believe, in the same machine Ed Lee Scanlon had. You're able to create bucking magnetic fields. I'm jumping around a little bit, but this idea, I'll tell a story. I'll try and tell it quickly. In 1990, I read a book called The Awesome Life Force. And in that book, it talked about the Caduceus coil, the Caduceus coil, the medical symbol of the that we see today, the two snakes. And it said, if you build one of these coils and pulse it with direct current, it will grow 10 times in size and levitate off the table. Well, that didn't happen. But I decided to make one that night. And I was sitting there staring at it. All I had was a 9-volt battery, a piece of steel with wire on it, and a chopper, something that would turn the current on and off very quickly. And basically, it's a crowbar. It was crowbarring the battery, making it very hot. So I took the battery and I put it in a saucer of water and froze it in ice. And I'm sitting there, you know, around midnight in my apartment, just sort of staring at it. And I'm noticing my eyes, nothing, you know, it never did the things they said it was going to do. But it did do three things. One, it was drying out my eyes. And the whole room was getting a charge. I could feel the hairs on my arm picking up. And I'm thinking, this is just a 9-volt battery. This should not be doing this. And then I got a little nervous because I could feel it kind of making a charge in the air. So I stepped away from it. After about 10 minutes, I turned it off. I would discover three things. One, it had magnetized all the steel tools on the table. I could pick up the wrench, the screwdriver with the wrench. Everything was magnetized. And they were still magnetized in the very same way today. Another thing I noticed was I had a steel ruler that just happened to be right in front of the coil. And when I take that ruler and run a compass along it, that compass spins. And that's not the way you would expect a piece of steel to be magnetized in Earth's magnetic field. You would expect a bar magnet, you know, north on one end, south on the other end. Instead, it was this spiraling. And I know what I noticed was, well, again, the third thing came the next day. I went to work and one of my coworkers said, "Bill, you got some sun yesterday." I'm like, "No, I didn't get any sun yesterday." So I went and looked in the mirror and I had a sunburn from the neck up. And so whatever this thing was coming out of this caduceus coil, it was giving me a sunburn, which I think is directly related to the sun. I think the exact same energy is what comes from the sun and gives us a sunburn in the first place. Now, I was pretty spooked by all of this back then because I didn't know what it was. I kind of dropped the research, but I've come to learn today that this is connected to Edley Scanlon's pine cone device. Edley Scanlon had a thing that some kids saw him working on. I don't know if you're familiar with it. That's Carl Castle. He was seen pointing what they called ice cream cones at the rocks, and then of course you've got the Babylonians and the Assyrians showing their pine cones. And there's even pine cone devices in India, and similar. I haven't identified the pine cone in the Egyptian pantheon yet, but I know it's there because they all had this technology.
This is absolutely fascinating because I've made quite a study of Ed Leeds Scanlon. I've been to Carl Castle in Homestead, and it's a remarkable place. And it's obvious that whatever he did with methods that we do not have possession of. And what is interesting is this is the best description of what he did I've ever heard. What you've just said is extraordinary.
Yeah. Now, I'm sorry.
Well, wait, let me finish. Give me a couple more seconds.
Sorry. I tend to
That's okay. You're a very intense guy. That's fine. That's good. I think you've nailed this. I have to tell you, Bill, I'm glad you did come back because we just have to face the fact that they did have a technology in the past that was lost. And here's the fascinating thing about it. It was secret then, and it's still secret. Why didn't Ed Leeds Scanlon tell anybody about it? Why was he so secretive? What is the secret? And that fascinates me because it's got something to do with it, and I don't know what. Mm-hmm. But Ed apparently knew that if he made it public, it either wouldn't work anymore or something bad would happen.
I think he was threatened. I think he was threatened. Ed, I don't know if you know much about Ed's early history, but he was an alchemist apprentice in Latvia. And when he came to the United States, he had all this knowledge of alchemy that he learned in Europe. And he didn't like study this stuff and figure it out. He knew when he hit the ground running how to build this device and how to use it. And if you go to Carl Castle, all the pieces are there. They've got this generator looking thing that's made out of a engine block. You've got wires. There's some information I found about how he had a car generator from a Model T that he hooked up to a gasoline lawnmower engine, and he pretty much created his own generator to charge batteries that he had. And he was there's all this information about how he had a bunch of car batteries in his workshop. I think what he did was he charged the batteries during the day and use those batteries, like I use the 9-volt battery, to send chopping magnetic electric currents into the pinecone device. And the thing about the pinecone device is that, unlike in the Cadesis coil, or the Cadesis, I always have trouble remembering how to say it, but in the Cadesis coil, you've got the nodes. Every node is where the electricity is crossing over. And what's going on in that spot? In our use of magnetism and electricity, we're always creating magnetic fields that pull at each other. If you have a north and a south pole, they pull at each other. But if you have two north poles or two south poles, they punch at each other. They buck at each other. It's kind of like imagining somebody pointing two fire hoses at each other. Somewhere in the middle, that fire hose would start doing this stuff, and this stuff would come flying out in all different directions. That's what happens at a node in the Cadesis coil when it's pulsed with electricity and creates these two magnetic fields that push against each other. Well, if you look at the pinecone device, I actually have a pinecone here I can show you because I started to work on it. But if you look at the pinecone, every one of these spots is where the wires would crisscross. And so there are so many nodes on this, I can't even count them. And they would take these devices, you know, and point them at stuff. And if you notice, they got wings. And those wings aren't like ready to fly wings. They look more like a fan. And I remember getting a sunburn from the device. And I'm thinking, maybe, you know, it actually can be blown away. Whatever's frothing out of this magnetic bubbles, okay, it can be directional by actually wind and vibration pushing it away. So they use wind and vibration to push it into the stone. And it literally goes in, wicks out some of this magnetic material, makes it soft. And then, you know, you just leave it and the ambient magnetic material will collect back in it, just like wax will get cold and hard again. Same thing happens to the stone. This magnetic material comes in, the matter returns back to its normal state, gets heavy and gets hard. And so, you know, these are the
kinds of... Wait a minute, Bill. Hold it up again, will you?
Oh, sure.
Okay. We've commented many times that the Egyptians, where are their tools?
Yes.
I think Bill's holding one in his hand right now. Theirs may not have looked like that, but somewhere, and probably in a lot of places, they are illustrated. They didn't hide them at all. We mm-hmm. just didn't understand what they were.
Yeah, I think I have discovered it. I think I have found it in this device. Okay, this is the Ankh. And I think the Ankh, they're doing something with bucking magnetic fields at the node point where these two cross. So you can see them always holding their Ankh and kind of pointing it, you know, pointing it away or whatever. And I think that's the Egyptian version of the pine cone. But I've never come across one, and I haven't tried to, reverse engineer that technology as yet.
Well, you should do some reverse engineering. You could make yourself a rich man.
Again, getting back
unless,
to Edward.
Unless, of course... somebody comes after you, which is, I think, happened to Ed, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they did. There is stories of the FBI coming to talk to him and how that kind of put a chill on his work.
And also, Nikola Tesla, they stole all of his papers after he died and didn't give them back to anybody. And these people steal and they hide.
I mean, I've been to... California. I've been to, the Mojave Desert area or around Edwards Air Force Base, and there are all these underground facilities. And my friend and I, we went. He used to work at Edwards as an air traffic controller. And one day we went down and just started looking for all these places because he had a map of where they were. And sure enough, you can find them. And they're in the middle of nowhere. And as you get closer and closer to them, you'll discover that. The signs start getting a little bit, use of deadly force authorized for a house, a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere. Okay. If you're a FedEx truck, you can pass, but nobody else. And so we were waiting there. And sure enough, a station wagon came pulling out that had a Grumman aerospace sign. And there was a Grumman engineer inside of it. See, I was told by my friend Dave and another friend of his that what they're doing in that area is they're reverse engineering Roswell-like craft. And that a lot of these facilities are building pieces of this craft, and they don't know what they're doing. They're just building their piece, and they're all brought to this one Grumman site and put together. And then on every new moon, when the sky is dark, they fly them from Edwards to Area 51. And you know, this I have another friend who claimed to be able to sit on a mountain and watch them take off every new moon. Back in the 90s, he was always trying to get me to come down from the Bay Area to see him. And the one time I did come down, there was a snowstorm of 17 inches that kept prevented us from going out.
You know what they're doing? And I'm going to be very frank from about this. They're stealing our future from us. They're stealing the future of mankind. And you think to yourself, well, all these billionaires are building underground palaces and moving to build, buying land in Uruguay and things. They all know something dreadful is going to happen here, and we are on the line. And this technology, like this, is what could save us, and it is being hidden from us on purpose. And it goes way back to Nikola Tesla and probably before, and Ed Leete Scanlon. And you better be careful, mister. They're going to come after you if you're not careful. So you keep your powder dry.
Well, you know, I wondered about that for the last 20 years because I've known about a lot of this back from the 90s. And I really think we're seeing some kind of a breakout or a breakthrough in the country. I don't think I would be out here now if it was as dangerous as it was, say, 20 years ago. I mean, I believe in spirit guides. I believe I think I don't want to say overly protected. Anybody can, you know, look what happened to poor Charlie Kirk. Anything can happen. I think we're in the right time. I think we're in that renaissance where this information's going to start coming out. And
Well, I hope so because we're running out of time.
well,
Okay, let's now we're gonna we you and I we could talk all day. This is so fascinating, and I've got so many more questions. It's unbelievable. But we are here to show the device working. Now, folks, you've heard him say, explain why they could make it, why they did have the materials, and what they used. It's all on the table. Now, let's look at the device in operation. Bill, can you tell us what we are seeing?
okay, so m most plasma lamps that you might buy in the mall use a gas that is positively charged because plasma is usually they extract or they strip away an electron from a neutral atom and make a positive plasma. But there are other plasmas, there are other elements like mercury, like sulfur, and like oxygen that in an ionized state literally grab a stray electron and become a negatively charged ion. And negatively charged ions have the property of repelling earth ground. And so what you're seeing in the bottle is the plasma is ionized from a high voltage Tesla coil. Actually, I'm using a neon sign power supply, but that's just the only reason that's there is to charge the or to ionize the gas inside the bulb. The bulb is a mercury at low pressure, has no electrodes into it at all. It's called capacitive coupling, where the flower end has an electrode coupling the electricity through the glass, and the knife holder on the other side is also ionizing the gas on the other side and creating this direction. One of the things you'll see with this kind of plasma is it acts like water. It's not a coincidence that it acts like water. Water and plasma have a lot of things in common. I think they have everything in common. If we study plasma, we'll begin to understand liquids at a higher level.
But now, what I want to know is this: what about the electrical charge that was powering it? How would they have done that back in ancient
Okay.
Egypt?
Okay, I actually have my device here. I brought it for show and tell.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so one of the first things that I worked on was this thing called the sistrum corollum. And it's a device that you'll find in Egypt, really almost everywhere. And they'll usually you'll see it in the hand of somebody and he's doing something like this with it. And there's this thing called a Waz scepter, okay? And the Waz scepter kind of looks like this guy here. See if I can get a better shot. Anyway, a Waz
Yeah.
scepter. And the Waz scepter is shown touching the top of this device. And you can see it in a lot of images. The person sitting in a chair has a Waz scepter. And one of the things that the person will have is a headset, which I use here as just a simple a light bulb. And This light bulb is a neon bulb. Okay, it's not a, it has no filament inside. It just has neon gas and two electrodes, and so it wouldn't run. It wouldn't be able to be lit with a battery. It needs high voltage, and this device creates that high voltage. So all they did was they would touch the side. It has a battery in the handle. It has a voltaic pile. I have a 9-volt battery because I'm not going to mess with acids, and it's got a coil on top, and then these magnetic contacts at the top. And so what happens is when you touch it, you start to, I don't know, you can see that.
Yeah, I can see the sparks.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is an electrical generator for producing high voltage AC. And they've got versions of this thing depicted at Dendera that are 30 feet tall. And I even found a spot in the back of the temple where you can see where they plug them in. So they use batteries, they use induction coils, and they use magnetic contacts. Batteries, induction coils, and magnetic contacts. And that's how they made electricity. And,
you know, I have to just stop you again. That's amazing. And it's so obvious. And you have a whole vast community of people who won't see what is right in front of anyone's face. I'm not stupid, and I can tell you I've seen these reliefs myself, and I understand exactly what you're talking about. And my guess is that a lot of people in the archaeological community understand it too, and they just don't want to go there because that would mean that all the papers and so forth that they've been writing for years are wrong.
Mm.
So therefore, they're just not going to do that to their careers. They'd rather defend their mistakes than admit them. That's the bottom line.
And yeah, I read a book, I forget what it was called, the Ankh or something, but it talked about how a lot of this material was found during the Napoleonic period.
By Napoleon's archaeologists, right.
And what Napoleon did, what his archaeologists did, was they would ship stuff to the Vatican, okay? And the Vatican would, like, evaluate it. And the person they had evaluating this technology was Alessandro Volta, the guy who invented the battery. And did he really invent the battery?
Or
did
he just? Oh, my God. Incredible.
Right. And so
he didn't invent the battery, stole the battery from the Egyptians.
Exactly. And a lot of these devices I'm discovering, these people in Europe were sharing what they were finding from the Egyptians. So they got into high voltage static electrical balls. They would rub balls with, spin globes with cat fur and create charge that would make their hair stand out and stuff like that. That's the stuff they were testing or working with back in the 1700s. And that's exactly the time this stuff was coming out of Egypt. So I think there's a group out there that knows all of this history. Where are these devices? I think they're in the Vatican. You know, if you've ever seen the end of Indiana Jones, where did they put the Ark of the Covenant? In that big warehouse in the middle of nowhere. Okay, I think there's something like that in the Vatican. And, so again, it throws everything on its heels. It's like all of a sudden, we're not only, not as smart as we think we are. We owe a lot to the Egyptians already. And I think we knew that. I think our science, at some level, our scientists, the ones that work for the government, know this.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. That's why they were all over the museum in Tehran. I mean, in Baghdad. And they looted it for all that stuff that was in there. And they looted it because they were looking for things that would help them understand this more deeply. But who didn't they tell us, the people?
Well, yeah, and I fall back on the idea of maybe there's something we don't know, okay? For example, one of the things I was told by my spirit guidance, they took credit for that 17-inch snowstorm that's kept me from going to that mountain at Edwards Air Force Base that night. They said, under no circumstances should you go to that mountain. You think they don't know your friend is sitting on that mountain watching them? I said, stay away from that mountain. And so I just have this understanding that these these people know what they've got. And but so then I would ask, well, what is this device? What are these aircraft, these spacecraft used for? And they said to me, actually, they told me this back in Egypt in 97. They said, Bill, you are never going to figure out everything until you incorporate the intergalactic war. Okay, there's an intergalactic war. If you look at Egypt, it wasn't just like knocked down, it was blown up, it was smashed. There's indications on some of these temples that they were hit with some kind of weapon that scorched the stone. Okay, so they said, if you don't incorporate the intergalactic war into what you're doing, you'll never understand what the true history of the planet. And I think what they told me was we are building these craft, shipping them to Area 51 so that they can be used just like America built weapons during World War II for Europe. We're building weapons for this cosmic war that's going on in space. This is what I was told. And I see nothing. That's why when you get back to why aren't they telling us? Well, it might be because they're trying to hide it, or it might be they're trying to protect us. I mean, sometimes you don't tell children everything that you know until they're mature enough to handle it. And I think we're reaching that point because of the yugas, because of the movement of the stars through the heavens. We're getting to a point where our intelligence is now increasing. And they call this the ascension, whatever you want to call it. But our intelligence is increasing, and we're getting to the point where we can handle this information, this adult information. And so that's why I think, you know, this is a good time to bring this information out, because as a culture, there's that old line that Reagan said, how quickly would we come together if we knew the Earth was being attacked from space? And, you know, all of a sudden, all of our problems would just drop away. All of our differences, we would be seen as Earth people working together. And I really think there's something to that. Okay, so you mentioned last time in one of your lead-ins about the idea that there was once a huge flood that flooded out the oceans. And before that, the civilizations that we would call Atlantis were actually very deep, what we would call the ocean today. They're very deep.
They're now 450 feet under the ocean today, yeah.
Right, and so that made me think, it's like, because there's two kinds of floods that you can have on the Earth. One is something causes the ice pack, the ice packs on the North and South Pole to melt, and you'll get floods. But there's another kind of flood that I think happens, which is a bunch of water appears on the Earth that wasn't there before. Okay, and my understanding of what they're finding in the pyramids, if you look at some of the new ground radar images, they're pulling up these spiral huge spiral tubes and things that are underneath. And if you look at it, it looks very much like what Tesla was doing with the Wardenclyffe Tower. And this all gets back to me to the firmament, the firmament of Noah. If you read the Bible, it talks about the firmament. It prevented you from seeing the stars. And it was very kind of lit up like an aurora. And my understanding is the sun is electrical. And it brings electrical energy to the Earth. And that electrical energy is kind of isolated from the ground through the ionosphere. But if you could charge the ionosphere, you'll actually bring that electricity closer to the Earth. And when you bring that electricity closer to the Earth, it only takes one antenna now to tap into this sun's energy. Tesla was not building a way of transmitting electricity. He was building a way of tapping the sun's energy and bringing it down and making use out of it. And the key to doing that is charging the ionosphere. And if you charge the ionosphere, a weird thing happens to the water on the planet. Planet starts getting very dry because all this water collects up in the firmament, up in the ionosphere. So I believe the pyramids were the Atlantean version of the Edley Scanlan, of the Tesla Wardenclyffe Tower. And they were keeping the ionosphere charged for the whole planet. It's how the Vimanas were working in India. It's how some of the work was being done. All these other places were just tapping the same. It's kind of like what Elon Musk does with his Starlink. You know, he puts this Starlink in space. Anybody anywhere on the planet can now get internet. And I think they were able to do the same thing by charging the upper ionosphere. When the pyramids were destroyed, I think maybe 250,000 years ago, not 10,000 when the Younger Dryas and things like that, much further back in time, when it happened, it caused the water that was in the ionosphere to come down as rain. And that flooded everything. And now we live on the highlands, like you said. All of our cities, all these towns and things like Egypt, they would have been on the mountaintops, Tibet, places like that. They would have been on the mountaintops of the earth back then, and then it got flooded. And the real key for me came from that prairie, that map that Graham Hancock brings out all the time, that
The
shows,
Prairie Reese map.
right, it shows Antarctica without ice, okay? So
Yeah,
all
and it's there. It shows Antarctica without ice, bottom line. And you can talk about, you can put it aside and explain it away any way you want. It's still there.
Exactly. And so what would have made it possible for someone to make a map of Antarctica without ice there? Obviously, it's because the Earth was much drier back then. And I think when once the firmament fell and the water collected on the Earth, it caused a lot of moisture in the environment, and the Antarctic started to ice up, and it started to ice up very fast. So I'll go a little bit further. I think Antarctica is Atlantis, because if you look in Plato's description of it, he says it was located in the middle of the Great Sea. And the Atlantic definitely isn't the Great Sea. Beyond the Pillars of Hercules, located in the middle of the Great Sea. And if you look there, the Atlantic is not that big. The Pacific's big enough. But is it really the Great Sea? Now, if you take the Earth and you spin it around and put Antarctica in the middle, now you've got every ocean in every direction. You got the Indian Ocean, you got the Pacific Ocean, you got the Atlantic.
Yeah, that's right.
Well,
That would be the Great
that's
Sea.
the middle of the Great Sea. And so I believe Atlantis, the real Atlantis, not one of its colonies like we find in Egypt, was located in Antarctica. And I believe that's why they're limiting access to Antarctica, because they know they're finding stuff under the ice that, would prove the existence of Atlantis.
You know, back in 1989, I was in Auckland, New Zealand. And everyone was up in arms in Auckland because of the fact that the US Air Force was flying missions to Antarctica out of their local airport, not an air base, but their local airport, and keeping everybody up at night after night. And I saw those planes coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. There was a massive something going on down in Antarctica at that time, and there's no evidence of what it was to this day.
Right.
I have to say, I spent probably 20 years of my life having flood dreams that I couldn't explain, where this huge flood would come, and absolutely enormous, that it would be here in Santa Monica. There would be gigantic raindrops pouring out of the sky, and in my place, in our family place in Texas, the water, it's above the Guadalupe River, which everybody now knows is a very dangerous river. Then I've seen the Guadalupe flood myself. I mean, I almost got caught in a flash flood there when I was a boy, and it recently flooded and killed a bunch of kids because these greedy camp people put the children's cabins right on the water, which you should never do it near the Guadalupe anyway. In these dreams, it's not just that kind of a flood. It's massive. It's bigger, 100 times bigger than the biggest flood we've ever seen on the Guadalupe. And I'm wondering if these aren't precognitive dreams. It's very frightening, because it just the sense of something coming out of nowhere. I can't forget the visitors saying it will come upon them unaware. When I asked what would happen, it will come upon them unaware. And I've been trying to figure out what the hell that meant ever since. And of course, they're not going to tell me. They never do. They never do.
Well, I think that's the beauty of being human, because I think what one of the things we're discovering is our intuitive, our telepathic intuitive ability. And I think one of the things my spirit guides tell me all the time is that in the future, you won't be able to tell a lie, because people will know your thoughts. And I really think that we're already starting to see that. People are kind of waking up. And I think there's a reason that we our species is pushed down and then allowed to flourish again. It's a season. It's just like the seasons on Earth. You've got fall, spring, summer, winter. Those same seasons go around through the yugas. And when you're in the winter time, your intelligence kind of gets pushed down. You get pushed down into this, but when you get to the other side, more of this energy starts coming into the solar system. See, like right now, there's all this interest in climate change. One of the things I learned from my studies is the climate is driven by the sun. The sun is very important in
It's
feeding it.
absolutely critical.
Right.
Yeah.
And like in my in my studies, it's the sun that drives. I'm always being asked, global warming, we're seeing this, global cooling. Why is it happening on other planets? Why is Mars seeing it? Why is
Well, listen,
Jupiter?
we're getting too far from
Very good.
our conversation here. We're going, and we have to continue this dialogue in the future, because it's a wonderful dialogue, and we're going to address things like weather and ancient floods and so forth and so on with Bill at some time in the future.
That'd
But
be great.
right now, we've done enough for one day and hopefully blown a few minds completely. So, Bill, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
Thank you, William. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of unknowncountry.com is Anne Streber. I'm Whitley Streber, your host for Dreamland.